Oh, good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks. We are so excited to be, taking this journey with you along the mother line. And today we are so excited to have poet, interdisciplinary artist, and culture worker Stephanie J.T. Russell in the studio with us. And her husband's here too, sort of like in the room. Hey, Iya Joe.
Hello, Mama Wanda. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, Iya Joe is like, we are so honored to have her with us. She is, I call her Iya Joe because her middle name is Josephine, and that's my grandmother's name, and she is sort of representing for grandmother, Josephine, and just like nurturing my soul and my spirit. She is my mama. So Iya means mom. And in Yoruba. And so, I mean, she couldn't have actually born me, you know, but hey, there are a lot of ways to be reborn, and this is my mama, y'all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We kind of mother each other in some interesting ways, I think. We learned to do that when we were together for those weeks when you came to New York. That was a very special time. You know, we went from warm acquaintances to real friends, real sister friends. And, I felt us mothering each other through that time.
Yes, yes, yes. All those wonderful warm foods and the gardens and the walks and the talks and the meditations, you know, where you just sort of touch me lightly.
Well, you know, this is a real honor because I love what you do. I love how you bring us together in a way that is so personal and relaxed and open in this wonderful platform of yours. And so it's a real honor to be there with you. And tell me how you'd like to start. What would you like us to talk about?
I'm going to read your bio, finish reading your bio, and then I was just wondering if you could just do a centering something, because you're good with that.
Okay.
So, you know,
yeah,
like, so that even though we're across the miles, you know, and we're being joined by these other wonderful spirits. You know, just a sort of like a grounding, you know, just, you know, you do what you do. So your most recent creative nonfiction book is One Flash of Lightning. is that Shango? A poetic treatment of the classic samurai code, Andrews MacNeil. Your poetry, essays, and visual art are anthologized in books and journals, including Colossus, Body, Xavier Review, The Winter Anthology, Sequestrum, Lightwood, and Arlejo. Is that how you pronounce that?
Arlejo.
Arlejo. Okay. Mm-hmm. Arlejo. And that's spelled A-R and then capital L-I, capital J-O.
Mm-hmm.
You have performed and exhibited at venues such as the New Museum, the Griffin Museum of Photography, the Albright Knox, Bowery Poetry Club, and the Berkeley Museum. A visiting teaching artist at New York University, Vassar College, the West African Network for Peace Building, and other noted institutions. You received the overall winner award from the 2022 Wirral Poetry Festival in the United Kingdom. As Dutchess County Poet Laureate, you are curating Stream of Life, a series of intercultural poetry and multidisciplinary events featuring diverse Hudson Valley artists. We're talking Hudson Valley as in the Hudson River, as in Ocean River, as in New York, right, y'all?
Mm-hmm.
So welcome. Welcome, Iya Joe. Take it away.
Well, you know, you had mentioned the medicine of life that I relate to in one of your emails. And when you said centering, I think you know me well enough to know that's that's a very important fulcrum of what that means in my practice, my spiritual practice, which is my life practice, which feeds my artistic practice, and it's like a big circle. It's a big circle. It's like the beak and tail of the Tsongkhapa bird. And so I'd like to invite everybody for a couple of minutes to contact that circular flow within you that begins with the breath going nice and low into the belly and rising up again through the spine and flowing down again like an endless waterfall of quiet, still energy. It's dynamic stillness. Dynamic stillness within, the life force within, the ashe, the chi, the ki. So many names for this universal flow that keeps us here, anchored to our mother, the earth. And if we sit with that and with each other and are aware that there are several of us in this conversation right now, thanks to Wanda's picks, which is a means of bringing us together, and the illusion of distance and the illusion of separation just falls like a curtain. And we stay with that internal flow, that mother line within us. Dynamic stillness. And that's happening between us all. And when I say all, I mean it with a capital A. How does that feel?
Oh, that just felt so lovely. I am here.
Yeah, me too.
So tell us about, you know, how you got here, like your mother line, like who's your mom? Call some name. Who's your mother's mother? Who's your mother's 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 mother?
Mm-hmm.
How are we so blessed to have you with us? How'd you get here?
How'd I get here? Well, in this lifetime, I came through a very rich mixture of mother lines from a few intense parts of the world, through Italy, through Mauritania, and through Jewish lineage, European Jewish lineage on the paternal side. And this is a place that I travel through less overtly consciously than I used to. It's become so internalized and so much a part of something that is as rich as deep as culture, but deeper still than culture. Something that that I feel very connected to is my lineage as a descendant of so many women. My mother had five sisters and two brothers, one of whom was a twin. My grandmother was a chestnut farm worker. And, you know, people talk about urban farming, but a lot of our grandmas did that long before that became a sort of a term that's used widely. And they did it in their backyards, in cities, in towns all over this continent, as they had learned to do where their original lineage came from all over the world. So that had a huge dawn me before I was even ready to appreciate it. And as I grew older, meaning into my teenage years, I looked around me and I realized that I was the fruit of all of these women who worked in the home, but they also worked outside the home. And they worked in factories, and they worked on what they called truck farms back in the day. My mother worked in retail. I had an auntie who was the maiden aunt in the family, and she taught third grade for her entire career, for a 60-year career. And they all just, you know, by example, they passed on this sense of responsibility back into life, that you treat life with great respect and great gratitude. So I think that the mother line that I've come away with at nearly 70 years old is that, the heart of gratitude. And that's what gives me tremendous energy, no matter what's going on. I mean, as we speak, I'm sitting here in the recovery room where my husband is resting after a cardiac ablation. And I'm loaded with gratitude because, first of all, I'm with you, Mama Wanda. And that gives me a lot of beautiful nectar. You know, I was really, really looking forward to this. And we're surrounded by highly capable, highly compassionate people here at New York University Hospital. And I know that came from my mother line, that ability to find the grace in sometimes the most frightening and threatening circumstances, and to recenter myself in spirit, period. You know, when the material world appears to fail us, then we have to go back into that source, you know. So that's the long and the short of it for me. That's the medicine of my life, is gratitude. You know, our mutual friend and great artist, Destiny Muhammad, always posts Good Gratitude Day on her social media. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I just love that, you know, and unabashedly and unashamedly grateful she'll post, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's really the food of life. That's the food of the soul that gives us energy and can nurture us artistically and keeps us reminded that very, very few people on this planet can really function alone, that we need each other, and we're part of this vast and subtle and rich web of life. And, you know, we're really lucky in that way, that we have the consciousness to share it in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, that you gave me a moment in time where I could invite, you know, the two of us and whomever else is listening to just sit together for a minute, just be together. And being together is, wow, what a beautiful way to wake up and go to sleep in the world and fill the day in between.
Yes, yes. Do you have any poems you might want to share to sort of give us a little flavor of the stories that you're telling us now about your grandmother, you know, the chestnut farmer, and and your mother, and your aunties, your dad?
Yes. And I mean, all of that. I'm just waiting. I brought my laptop here to the hospital so that I could read them without shifting off the phone. This is so much fun. I'm also having this incredible wave of deep nostalgia for my 6 years, my second 6 years in the Bay Area, and how that, you know, brought me to community with people that remain in my life and always will remain in my life. It's really pretty amazing. So let me get
And you know, and then, you know, Hurricane Katrina anniversary, the 20th anniversary is next year. Isn't that crazy? Like, what, 20 years? And you reminded me a few years ago that that was how we met, you know, through the organizing around Words mm-hmm. Upon the Water, the anthology of artists and poets that, you know, we pulled together to use as a fundraising tool to send money to some of the grassroots organizations on the ground, like Common Ground and Common Ground Clinic, and, you know, some of the folks that weren't in the government nonprofit loop, but were doing real, real important work, you know, around rescue and repair and continue. Some of these organizations are, you know, they're having their 20th anniversaries as well. And they're, you know, still helping community, because there's some things you don't necessarily recover from. You just, you heal, but you still have lingering traumas.
Yeah, I mean, the land and the air and the water all underwent such a profound disruption. And when I was invited to participate in the publication that you envisioned, Words Upon the Water, I was, first of all, I was really, really honored because it was being edited by Kim Shuck, who was becoming a close friend, and I knew who you were, but we had not yet met. And so it opened the door to a whole bunch of friendships deepening, as well as new friendships. And I just thought it was so visionary to say, I know you went out there, Wanda, and you checked in with people down in New Orleans and said, what do people need that's not really being addressed so publicly? And they said, wheelchairs. And, well, yes, you know, people were probably like watching your wheelchairs flowing away. And at the other piece of it that was so compelling for me is that, you know, there I was in the Bay Area, and I had one or two friends in New Orleans in the Ninth Ward, and I couldn't go down. I was not in a position to go down financially and be there and do something really practical with my hands on. But then you created this opportunity, and the frustration of not being able to do anything to contribute fell away. And I really want to thank you for that vision you had, because it was a wonderful time of connection, I think, for old friends and new friends in the poetry community. So given that you did start by talking about that wonderful project, I'm going to read a poem called Daily Migration of Crow. That the last line in the poem kind of epitomizes to me what that project and what our human need and our human interconnection and mutual reliance is about. Daily Migration of Crow. Each and every dusk, you draw near as you can to the end of day hegira. The last hunt behind them, the crenellated arrow forms, lifts, points west, scribing the irised haze. You want to believe they never go to sleep hungry, and if they do, that any ache is dispersed through the flock in equal, painless slivers, prolonging their heat for daybreak's commute into the sun. Their evening song tells you such equanimity is not merely that without it, the roost of thousands would perish in the frost. The last two stragglers tailing the squadron are irreplaceable in the necessity.
Yeah. Irreplaceable. Yes.
We're all needed. We're all needed.
Yes, we are.
And that web of mutual aid and mutual reliance, I think, is what keeps the world from going off its axis. You know?
Yeah. So wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it was like, you know, growing up in, where did you grow up? Did you grow up in New York?
Yes.
Yeah. What it was like, you know, being a girl in New York and just the family dynamics and, you know, tell us some stories, because I know there was, you know, some rupture and some repair, and there's some secrets that you uncovered later on, which explain things. And, you know, we all, when we're born, you know, we come into these worlds already fashioned, and then we, you know, sort of try to figure out how to fit in and also how to make an impact. And you are an all around artist. I mean, you know, you're really a creative being. You know, you went to art school, you know, you're a photographer, you're mixed media artist, you do textiles. I've got Sankofa print hanging in my living room. You know, I look at it every day. You know, when we come into your house, it's a shrine. I mean, there are candles, there are altars, you know, like you carry all of your experiences travel with you. Like when we behold Iya Joe, we see your lineage, we see that history, we see, you know, a woman who is making medicine with her life wherever and whenever she opens her eyes, and even when your eyes are closed. I mean, you have such faith too. So if you could talk a little bit about, you know, tell us some stories about, you know, your people, your mom, you know, your cousins, you know, the things that were hidden that, I mean, because I was just thinking about, you know, sometimes we don't know things because when we look in the mirror, we don't see them, right? Yeah, I'm talking about, you know, your African ancestry and, you know, and so how that landed. And you've traveled. Like, you've been in these spaces that only spirit could put you. And you've made manna and quail and, you know, figs and, you know, strawberries, which you grow, you know, at the community farm, you know, down the street from your house. And, you know, it's like, it's just amazing. It's amazing. I'm telling your story. Sorry.
No, you're doing a much better job than I can right now. Actually, you know, you're reminding me of our conversations. I mean, as you were talking, I was, you know, watching as we told stories to each other and shared some of those family secrets and some of those family wounds and the healing that we're really responsible to pursue in our lives. You know, the healing path is a responsibility, especially if one wishes to fully enter a spiritualized dimension of existence. You really want to walk that path, then healing is a responsibility. And then it becomes really easy once that is working on you and helping you to discharge old energy, recycle trauma so that we don't become overly attached to the idea of it as our persona, that you move past that and you become a force of healing within your community, because everybody carries that within them. They carry the potential to heal and be healed. So I think that because my family's complex lineages and histories created both a sense of powerful unity as well as some very painful ruptures, I was already a bit of an outsider, you know. My our family unit was beset with a lot of grief and fear out of my father's post-World War II trauma. And that trauma was an enormous force that really determined the way our days went, the way our nights went. And I have to say that, you know, part of the mother line of healing that knows no gender and applies to us all really came to my father when he was 75. And he decided to do long-delayed healing work on himself. And he won our love for that. And he died at peace for that. And I think that the complexity of cultural lineages when they end up in a car crash together under the same roof are actually potential pathways into enlightenment and into freedom. You know, we live in a dimension on this planet that is, you know, the Buddha said, right, it's the nature of the material world is pain. That's what it is. But it's through that exposure to grief and the struggle to get free that we find a kind of beauty that could be called grace. You know, you used that word in one of your emails to me about, you know, what we might be talking about. And it has really stuck with me, that one word, that grace is the outcome of families that come together to create new families when there is intention to heal. And sometimes it takes decades. Sometimes the opportunity is lost altogether. And people who might believe in the return of spirit into the material world through reincarnation know that, you know, there is a next time that you bring the lessons in from the previous life. I feel very grateful to have come from some really unexpected combinations of blood lineages, cultural lineages, and the lineages of faith, as you pointed out. Faith, when I really discovered it, when I left home and went on my own, real young, faith was in me. I had such a strong feeling that the torn up bits of me on the inside were just waiting to learn how to weave a loom of strength. And I couldn't do that on my own. How could I do that on my own? None of us can. Mm. And it was through friendship and through receiving mentorship and then growing strong enough and whole enough that I could weave mentorship into what it was I tried to bring to others. And so there's this, again, that circular breath of healing that, you know, most of us pay a high price to learn it. And I don't mind the price. It's rent for being here. It's rent for being here in the planet. And yes, just like that fellow who was he running for president? That wonderful guy who said the rent too damn high. Like, do you remember him? About, like, I don't know, what was that, like 10, maybe 15 years ago? And I, on the human karmic level, I don't think it's too high. I think that we have magic in us that comes down through thousands of years and lineages we can't even begin to remember, things that got lost along the way over thousands of years, cultural lineages in particular, places that we've been that we don't know, places our ancestors just, you know, from the ether can share with us energetically, and that's about it. So I'm sorry, excuse me. I don't know. So I'm sorry. I just I had to answer the nurse who came in to see about my husband. So we're going to have a little bit of background here. But that's about it.
No problem.
I mean, I hope that wasn't too elliptical. But that, you know me, that's the way I think, and sometimes it's the way I talk.
I
I'm thinking I'd like to read a poem that is very much about the theme that you brought up that I was just talking about. It's called Song of Imprints Erasure. And I don't think I had a chance to share that with you when we were together in New York, because I think it was written after you left. Song of Imprints Erasure. Every winter, the same slow-moving glacier glides into the room, nudges hindsight further upstream. reminding this body its erasure began long ago. Nearly gone now, this body sees everything at once, bursting into sandstorms at the merest hint of a mummy or a beach. I'm fine with that, relieved there's no place left to go anymore except deeper. In this case, to the cellar of a house that no longer is, as I no longer am. Knees folded tight as a seminary pleat, I duck under the crooked basalt lintel. From this low, chalky tread, fingertips reach up easy to caress the blackened joists. Before me, mute gypsum floor tiles spread sea-like into the dim, anodyne expanse of childhood's occult immensity. Alit in the gloss of a scant window set atop the foundation, vacant jars tally extinction's harvest. In mannequin silence, the laundry mangle hovers, speechless confessor of our dirt-laden lives. Chorus of busy hands gone still as cellar stone, no longer pressing wine, seed, and oil, grinding fruit, meat, nuts, and wheat. This body of cellared obsolescence, corrugated, serrated, ridged, wired, and clamped. This body, disappearing witness of disappearance, thinning shawl of oxygen, athenaeum of no longer useful memory, barely stubbornly useful to itself alone, working both hands in the dark.
Oh, that's so lovely. No, I don't know that poem. Yes. That's really
so
beautiful.
You know, I was thinking about my grandma's basement, mm-hmm. and mm. how she had all of these jars. I call them vacant jars because, you know, that house doesn't even exist anymore. But those jars were full of preserves, you know, tomatoes and squashes and, you know, you name it. She grew it and put it up in that basement. In that basement, you know, like little kids everywhere who have been exposed to any basement, I was fascinated and a little afraid of that basement, but I found a lot of comfort and inspiration in looking back to it in that poem.
Mm. Yeah.
All those hands doing all that work, you know, making something mm. from nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What stories do you read to yourself at bedtime? And are any of these stories, any of these your mother's stories, stories your mother told you, or stories your mother told you?
I think it's at night it's less stories than conversations,
mm-hmm.
you know, teachings that I receive that become conversations. The questions that I used to have as a younger woman about my folks, you know, all my folks.
Mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned to you when we were together that my eldest cousin called all of our cousins the 38 great. There were 38 of us on the mm-hmm. maternal side. And I was kind of the odd one out, but everybody loved me anyway. You know, I was all about just disappearing into books or drawing, you know, and then mm-hmm. when I got older, painting and writing. And there was that imprint of the questions that I did not ask until later in life and the ones that I kept to myself anyway. So those come to me at night when I find myself opening my heart to the departed family members who moved on to another plane when they died. And I get very mm-hmm. clear messages from them. I get messages about the beauty of the mess that sometimes we had to deal with or the messes and the way in which the women were the vertebra of the spine of family. And they were, you know,
mm-hmm.
they were tough. And through that toughness, that's where you got the nurture. And they nurtured with food and they nurtured with example. That's how, you know, you had to mm-hmm. learn in my family by watching and watching and learning and doing and carrying that forward to the day when you left home. And so it was a tough nurture, but it was invaluable. It really taught me to pay attention. Once I shook off enough of the aura within me, the internal aura of some of the things I had survived in that family, the clarity mm-hmm. of what I was given was right there. I was watching myself do it. I had learned the good stuff. And they pass it on to me at night. You know, as aging continues to envelop my awareness of what it means to be alive now.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Talk about your house, your flesh house. You know, your body. How do you handle the aging process? If that is the body's changing landscape. Are you planting new seeds? If so, what kind? If a harvest is in, what have you yielded so far? What is it still growing?
I really liked that question when you wrote it in the email. I thought that was a really, really timely question. The body is clay. My body has served me really, really well. I've been a theater artist. I have been a tall ship sailor. I've done carpentry. I've been a dancer. And so the things that tend to go, you know, early have come upon me. But despite my limitations, I take that responsibility really seriously about taking as good care of myself as I can. And thankfully for Medicare, I've got decent conventional medicine doctors. And I also have a few really valuable people in my life who do integrative medicines from different traditions. And so this helps me to push through some of the more extreme difficulties that are neuromuscular, say, you know, pain, plain old pain. And the rest of it, I try to really continue to honor my childhood legacy of eating good food, respecting my body for what it is now, and doing everything I can to use the body as a means of bringing people together, you know, that it takes energy. It takes physical energy to do the kind of organizing like so many of us do in community. And that also includes the body-mind connection, taking care of my neural net, keeping it active with good and energizing and healing things, and with people. You know, people are the priority in my life. So everything else, whether it's raw inspiration or it's some form of actually giving, doing, being with people in a meaningful way, that all comes from the body and knowing that I really want to do this as long as I can. And I have a deepening sense of responsibility and a different kind of love for my body. I have the love now of being an elder in this body and the responsibility that represents and the joy that represents. So I'm trying to, you know, I'm sort of a compulsive weaver, you know, wherever it is I find myself in life, I'm trying to, you know, hold the strands that are the strongest and the most vibrant and hold the most potential for my own growth and in some way to support the growth of people who are I'm blessed to have in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just think about, you know, all of your projects as well as your role as an activist. I mean, you are a really involved neighbor in your community, literally. When you tell me stories about, you know, the house that you lived in, you know, before you moved to your present place and how that particular place where you live now, that house, it was literally spirit calling.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
it was not the house we thought we'd live in. You know, it was mm-hmm. like such an unexpected thing, right? So mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. that unexpected. I think that's a big part of staying as connected in community as possible. Community mm-hmm. is a very, it is fluid. It's constantly changing in one way or another because all these individual lives that make up community are going through thousands of changes all the time. Changes that people express, changes that people hold to themselves but are expressed in other ways that you can see and feel. And so I mm-hmm. think that that's a big part of why I love where we ended up in this funky old Hudson River, this poor old Hudson River town. And that there is a culture, especially downtown where we live, among so many people across generations and across communities who come together in mutual aid. And that culture of mutual aid has been one of the reasons why I do feel energized toward what involvement I can engage in. You know, this poet laureate, this county poet laureate thing for me was a platform mm-hmm. to cast light on people from the different communities that make up the richness of the Hudson Valley. The Mid-Hudson Valley has communities that have been around for generations that are more visible. And then there are smaller communities that have continued to sort of trickle in and build a space of beautiful, beautiful cultural energy and expression, but they're less known. So I thought, you know, the arts are like the best platform in my eyes for really casting light on what it is, the beauty that people bring into community, across communities, especially those that are less known. So that's been really, really fun. You know, I'm working with 6 cultural communities and collaborating with curators from those communities to, you know, mount poetry readings, workshops, and exhibitions. I'm an interdisciplinarian, so, you know, having many disciplines expressed, as many disciplines as possible expressed during this tenure as laureate, is where my direction comes from. And that's a reflection back to my past, my roots, my mixed up, you know, my mixed up homie stew of, you know, delicious homegrown vegetables and people. And, you know, there's just, I'm in awe of how people interact through goodness, pure goodness, you know, and that's what I love about living in the Hudson Valley, because there are a lot of people in our region, but it's much less dense than New York City. And mm-hmm. so it's more visible. You can see what people are doing more clearly and perhaps more slowly in this wonderful, rich feast of humanity. So that has been a really crucial part of why I fell in love with living in Poughkeepsie, New York, because there are so many cool people from so many different communities and cultural traditions. And people like to hang together. you know, they dig each other. They find ways to collaborate. We are no longer able to take to be growing food and at the level that we were growing in the backyard of another building that we own and steward down the street. And we got introduced to a wonderful young farmer, Farmer Nick, who is also Nick Jackson. He's a bass dancer, his brother's a trumpet player, and Nick is a really serious organic farmer. And so he had a fellowship come up for him, and he was able to bring some folks in to take over that backyard, which was a dream of my husband's and mine, that someone younger would come and say, oh, wow, here's this space. What can I do? And Nick gives away a lot of the food he grows to people who need it. He's very active in, at so many levels in community. So I have to say that that's another recent arising of that same principle that we've been talking about of interdependence and joy, the joy of interdependence. And what a happy thing it is when people find each other. And, you know, it's stone soup, like I started out saying, you know. It's a, a big, and you know, the pot just keeps getting bigger in my life, I have to say, because I never want to lose that that innate excitement for making something from nothing along with other people. That's where the pleasure comes in. That's where the joy comes in. And I believe that it is an act of beauty, that community collaboration, it's an act of beauty, and beauty is the most radical action we can undertake, no matter what our discipline is, whether it's artistic or it is some form of, you know, work in the business world or work in spiritual life, you know, that there is this principle of beauty. It's a principle of beauty. And it's most visible when it's shared. And that's what nurtures us. You know, that's what, you don't have to push the ugliness away that is generated out there in the artificial world, the world of artifice. It's just alchemy. You process it, you become it. And that is, I think, the greatest weapon against destructive impulses that have done so much damage to beings. The whole world is a living being, right? So to this living being of the world.
Yeah.
I hope I haven't been a little too abstract here today, but it's sort of where I am. You got me where I am.
Well, you know, sometimes the tangible and concrete sort of vanishes. And I was just thinking about some of those pieces you sent me of your art. I hadn't, though they're new work. Is Daniel okay?
Yes, he's okay.
Okay. The really beautiful one to have like really cryptic lines next to them, just like a canvas full of a beautiful color. You know what you sent me. But they're heck of cool. I mean, I just love it. I described, you know, your temple, which you also live in, and, you know, all the beautiful art, you know, your teacher is honored. And then you have, you know, your daily rituals, you know, to sort of, I guess, feed and inform your spirit and your connection to spirit. And we went for on my birthday a couple of years ago, we went on a journey because I wanted to see the, are they the Cascade Mountains?
No, the Catskill.
No. Not the Catskill. And Danielle was talking about how old they are. I mean, they're like old women, grandmothers. It's so cool because you can see that they sort of like settled into themselves. I mean, you know, like, you know, you have these mountains that are like, oh, my God, they're like glaciers. They're like touching the sky, but the Catskills, they're like, they have settled into their wisdom. and I just think about how, you know, as we settle into our bodies and embrace them in all of their changes and shifts, you know, because we're still here, you know. So anyway, you know, you took me on that journey, and I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about that, if you have a poem about that. And also wanted to invite you to share with regards to your appointment as the Dutchess County Poet Laureate. I just love Dutchess County. It just sounds so regal. and the stream of life, like, okay, so what do you know, like who or what is going to be presenting, you know, in the stream, like sort of where has the stream been and where is the stream going, and connect in. I know you have websites and things like that. So,
sure. the interesting thing about the valley is the Hudson Valley is that the historicity of the place, which you know also includes the colonization as well as the indigenous roots of the first people who walked in our valley, and the history of the mountains themselves, which once did touch the sky, you know, those were very, very critical points of dramatic erosion. Those mountains were huge, and as you said, they have settled into themselves in a very interesting kind of a way. Very female, very feminine, very rounded. You know, we have been corrected from calling them mountains to calling them a volcanic ridge, a vast volcanic ridge, and you can still feel that ancient primordial warmth in the earth when you walk it. Even in winter, there's something so motherly that vibrates up from within it.
Mm-hmm.
Stream of life. I've always loved the Hudson River. I've loved that river all my life, and it traverses and contains and attracts so much humanity and so much of our other animal relatives that, you know, we've been very, very lucky to have made our life there for the last 11 years. And so when the laureate thing came up and I was appointed, I already knew what I wanted to do. And so I went out and I went to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt historic site people and asked them if I could mount some poetry readings there. And they were really interested and drawn to the intercultural aspect. So we have readers, we have already begun there. I began with a reading of laureates past and present that included myself and my current colleague, laureate from Ulster County, the beautiful, brilliant Kate Himes, who is working on putting together stories and poems that are based on the histories of African-American folks from the Hudson Valley, going back, you know, over 100 years. It's really beautiful, elegant work, and she read from that growing catalog of her new work. And my dear friend, poet Gold Wilkerson, who has done so much to really energize poetry in the Hudson Valley for, oh gosh, you know, 15 years. And as laureate, she has done some really splendid collaborations with a small choir of young gospel singers, with her beautiful sung poem, Say Their Names. And she did this in numerous locations, including outdoor settings. And our dear friend also, Raphael Kosek, who has been a poetry educator all of her professional life and as laureate. She taught workshops and gave readings, so I put the four of us together. That was the launch of the FDR Historic Site Reading at the Visitor Center. And upcoming this May, we are having a reading on May 8th, a live reading of poets, just circumstantially, or I should say coincidentally, women poets from the South Asian diaspora, which was co-curated with Megha Sood, who has been producing tremendous poetry that touches on the diasporic experience that she has had coming here from India many years ago. And her writing is great, but she also organizes a lot of readings. So she's been a wonderful colleague to work with. later this year, we're having an African diaspora reading. We have a reading of Latinx poets coming up. And we have a reading in June that will be featuring poets of Chinese descent. And that includes the great Timothy Liu, who has had 12 books of poetry published and is currently teaching at SUNY New Paltz and at Vassar College. Marvelous poet. And we will also have my friend Nancy Schick-Nertl, who will be reading, and hopefully my friend Sifu Ken Law, who's a longtime friend from New York, first generation Chinese American. So we've got all this stuff happening, and it's really a lot of fun. The FDR is one site. The Chinese cultural events, which also include exhibitions as well as the readings, are happening at the Howland Cultural Center in a small and beautiful Hudson Valley town called Beacon, New York. And I also have a series every month through the end of the year at our beautiful historic library, the Adrian's Memorial Library, that's also building upon the same intercultural. It's an ethos, you know, it's a principle of curation. So I'm having a blast, and because I get to work with all these cool people, and they're people that I've already worked with, but also people I have wanted to work with or have wanted to cast light on, so that they get exposed to a larger audience, and an audience of folks that aren't necessarily strictly coming from a poetry or literature interest, but might be coming from other disciplines as well in the arts. And I think that's really important. It's an ancient tradition, and it's one that goes back, you know, all the way to the Tang Dynasty tradition of poets and scroll painters working together, as well as, you know, we can lead all the way up to collaborations between graffiti artists and hip-hop artists in the early days of hip-hop, you know, in New York City, I'm thinking of in particular. And, you know, the Afrofuturists did the same thing. Jazz is all about collaboration. And so that's the other piece of it. It's the multiplicity of people, the diversity of people, diversity of their art forms, and the surprises that come with that. So I've been also very lucky to work with Molly McGlennon, who runs the Indigenous Studies program at Vassar and also teaches poetry. And Molly's going to be reading as well at the FDR with Evan Pritchard, who's another noted Indigenous poet and cultural activist. So we, you know, I feel like this is a really karmic thing, because my whole history in the arts has really been driven by knitting diversity together in all its forms, you know, both from the intercultural as well as from the disciplinary kind of points of view. And it feels like I'm working out some old karma for myself that goes back lifetimes to this region, because by having these events happen at institutions that were founded largely out of a European, you know, wealth base and you know, both the library and the FDR, as well as some other venues, you know, and to say, look at who's here now. Look at who's been drawn to this stream of life that the Hudson River, this bountiful river, represents, and that the bounty of the people coming to that riverscape have contributed mm-hmm. to enriching and deepening our lives, you know? I mean, we're so lucky. It's just so cool, you know? And, mm-hmm. I feel that as a New Yorker, coming here to, a much smaller city, I've been able to scratch the diversity itch in my life, you know, because it's, it's needed. For me personally, it's needed. You know, I have to have that sort of creative friction that arises from looking around and seeing something unique to a given people, you know, and watching mm-hmm. forms mm-hmm. evolve out of traditional root systems, and seeing younger artists coming in and really disrupting the landscape of what you might identify with a given cultural group. I just find that mm-hmm. unbelievably stimulating and necessary, mm-hmm. you know. So mm-hmm. that stream mm-hmm. of life, it's the river and it's the streams of humanity that are drawn to it. And that actually mm-hmm. put down roots, you know, people who actually are making an investment in their lives that is going to be felt in generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking it's time for a poem. And after you share your poem, I found the art that I was thinking about. The trouble is you think you have time is one. And then each one of us is many persons. Love that one. and then a great many people are constantly coming to life in me, and these pieces, I mean, it's just like this particular one is these vibrating blue sphere over most mm-hmm. of the landscape of the work, and then you've got the words are in the same color as the sphere, and it's just really beautiful. So I just want to know if you could like talk about your visual art
sure.
a little bit for people who,
yeah.
you know, like they can't see it right now, but they can go online and see it because it's on your website.
Yeah.
But, I just wanted you to talk about that a little bit. And because, you know, you create with your whole self, how do you know, what to come in, literally?
Oh, I
and,
well,
and is that because, you know, has that changed because of, you know, your body maturing and changing,
mm-hmm.
you know, as you change the landscape. And then also last thing I want to mention, Mercer County is where Sojourner Truth was born, enslaved, and walked to freedom. And so I just want to sort of give people some context around where mm-hmm. you are.
Yes, we are it's a kind of an intersection, a physical intersection, geophysical intersection, where so much humanity has trod the land and so much humanity has both failed to be truly human and where so much humanity has recaptured the threads of humanity that we're seeing expressed now with so much new intercultural growth and people bringing their own indigeneity from all over the world into this new richness of experience. And people in the Hudson Valley really are feeling that richness of dialogue, conversation, creative collaboration, and admiration for each other. I mean, there was a lot there in that last bunch of ideas you had to talk about, and I'm trying to to grab.
I think we need a poem right now, you know, sort of to
talk
about that stream or whatever you're feeling. Another question I was thinking, because I don't know how much more time you have, because you're actually, you know, you're at a hospital.
well, we're going to leave soon. This is a good time for these questions because I feel like it, you know, you've led us down a good path of inquiry and caused me to think about other things than doctors and nurses, which I really welcome right now. I think that what's really calling me right now is a poem that celebrates the ephemerality of everything, and that celebrates the understanding that we're not here for very long. And much of those, the series that you were quoting of the, two-line phrases, each of those is taken from a different person. Large numbers of people are constantly coming to life, and is from the great Butoh dancer Kazuo Ono. And inside each of us is many persons. That comes from Luigi Pirandello, the great 19th century Italian theatrician. You know, he was a theater theorist, director, writer, most known as a playwright now by those who continue his work. And the one that says, the trouble is you think you have time is attributed to the Buddha. The trouble is you think you have time. So it's a good opener for this poem called Winter Light.
Okay.
The rooms we inhabit us as well. They beckon, and in you must go to bathe in all they know that you cannot yet fathom, and what in them you somehow already know, how these rooms also know you, how they roil up the subterranean tides of memory, loss, and desire for desire, a longing for longing itself, and the longing for a vessel to house it. You are these rooms, and they are you. You are a battalion of girders in the factory, a luminous arcade through the madhouse, a ceiling festooned with urgent memos and ashen pinups, a warren of doors left open to nothingness. You are this rot of oak and varnish, exhaling perished humors of water, mortar, and steel, the scattered revenant crouched in shadow beneath a chair, silently watching the dawn come in, waiting in charcoal vastness for no one ever to arrive again. In these rooms, you are a world enshrined, the elegiac collusion of its grace, its astonishments, its varicosities, its quotidian ecstasies, captured in a prism of ghosted calm. The room is your body, locus of memory, both true and misleading, where a reflection surpasses the thing reflected, where emptiness summons a yearning that only your presence fulfills. You are the dying room, giving birth to immense regal decay, to possibility itself. Sure, as restless, tender branches pushing through the senescent waste, the longing for longing, reborn in a broken sanctuary of magisterial light, pure as the purest young hope, when you were certain the moment patiently waited for you to simply reach and take it, the patient, eager moment awaiting your desire.
That's so beautiful.
It's like, you know, we do all this stuff, right? We're constantly doing it. Behind us, there's a, you know, or sitting on our shoulders, this little voice of awareness that, you know, the idea of legacy is only as good as when people forget us, but they are somehow tasting the fruit of whatever good we did. As you know, people will never meet. People in future generations are great, great, great grands. And this is where the radical act of beauty has to be the driving force. You can't let the ego be the driving force. You can't let your wish for somebody to crack open a book and find your name there 100 years later. It might not happen.
Mm-hmm.
Probably
mm-hmm.
won't happen for most of us, you know? And mm-hmm. and to do it just for the doing, for the generative power of putting beauty, a handprint of beauty on something.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. down the road a piece, we might not be around to see it, but somebody's going to feel it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I believe mm-hmm. in that generative power be above and beyond anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
yeah.
There's that continuity is what I'm talking about, continuity of vision around beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And aesthetics will change. And the structures, and certainly now with digital media, you know, we see a lot of changes in the ways in which people find beauty
mm-hmm.
or deliberately disrupt conventional notions of beauty. But that too will change.
Mm-hmm.
That too will go away. We have no idea what's coming. And I like
mm-hmm.
not knowing. I don't know what's going to happen in the future any more than I know or really care to say I am this, I am that. It's
mm-hmm.
not interesting. You know, what's
mm-hmm.
interesting
mm-hmm.
is being in the moment and being with each other in a real way. And passing on that unspoken legacy that's going to show up, you know, it will. The things
yeah.
we're not around to see, it's going to be somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking about, you know, about legacy, and as you mentioned, the generative power of beauty, and looking at beauty as a radical act. Yeah, and I was looking at some other questions. I sent you too many. Just, you know, things to think about. What do you wish you knew now that would have helped you prepare better for this period of grace?
Oh, gosh. That it was coming?
Oh.
I wish I knew it was
funny.
Coming. I wish I knew it was coming. My dear, dear, dear Mama Wanda, I wish I had known. I probably would have... not avoided certain sweetnesses that I could have enjoyed in my younger years. But, you know, you get it when you get it. And it mm-hmm. tastes sweeter now for having, I'm thinking, of course, about my husband who I met late in life, met him in the Bay Area working
mm-hmm.
together. And that's really, that's a great sign of it, you know, when something unexpected shows up and changes everything and makes you better,
mm.
makes you a better person. He's made me a better person. He really
mm.
has. And he does every day just by being who he is and paying
mm-hmm.
attention to who and what he embodies. And, you know,
mm.
the goodness of his people, you know, the lineage of his people,
mm.
you know, they've got a very beautiful thing going on as a continuing family. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, I think that as long as I'm breathing, even if I'm no longer standing someday, I'm going to
mm-hmm.
want to breathe in that touch of possibility. And with that, I think I'm going to bring my husband home from the hospital.
Okay. Very nice. Time to check out. Super. Cool.
Thank
cool.
you so much.
Excellent.
This is a blast. Now what I really want is to be in the same room with you physically and to be, you know, sharing a cup of tea and asking you all those questions because they're great questions. Seriously, they're
yeah.
really, really great questions. And I really treasured hearing you ask them, hearing the sound of your voice asking them.
Mm-hmm.
And
your
invitation
so
to do this, you know, has really made me feel recommitted to having more regular contact with you too, so that we can keep, you know, telling each other stories.
Okay. Well, I will hold you to that. We got a lot of witnesses.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Bless you. And thank
yeah.
you so much for this. It's really, really, it's been so healing for me, you know, on this particular day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Much gratitude. Thank you so much. And I'm having some technical issues I've been trying to get help on. So we're going to, I'm going to play in our closing Freedom Now Suite with Max Roach and Abby Lincoln. And we will revisit those beautiful songs that I wanted to play right now.
All right. Thank you so much, and much love to you.
Oh, thank you so much, and safe travels, and my love
Please
to Danielle.
Please blow a kiss to the bay for me when you take your sunset picture.
All righty. You take good care, Ia.
Okay, my dear.
Bye-bye. Bye. That was Freedom Now Suite, Max Roach and Abby Lincoln. And we're so honored to have Stephanie J.T. Russell joining us today as we continue this mother line. And today, we were streaming, along the Hudson River, very important waterway on the East Coast. And, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to our next conversation, next installation. You can certainly listen to these Motherline stories. You can continue listening to these Motherline stories, which began in March and continued with my own story, Wanda Sabir, and continued with Catherine Takara Waddell Takara, and scholar, poet, artist in Hawaii. And now, we have added Ia Joe's story to the tributary. So stay in touch. Let us know what you think. And again, thank you so much for joining us. Peace and blessings.